back on a lonesome-looking trail that led toward the hills. Jeff wondered who he was and where he was going. Jeff lengthened his stride to match the man ahead of him. Noah had told him their march had something to do with making a good impression on the Tahlequah people, so that the hundreds of Cherokees who had been compelled to join the rebel army might want to come back to the Union side. As the trim blue column tramped slowly into the outskirts and onto the town square, Jeff saw Indian people, mostly women and children, but also some men, standing in their well-trimmed yards, curiosity and fear in their brown faces. Most of them were dressed like white people. They looked like white people, too. And Jeff remembered what Joe Grayson had told him about the Cherokee mixed bloods who governed the nation. They had two legislative houses elected by the people, and a school system that surpassed that of many of the states. Colonel Weir had given strict orders that anybody caught stealing or looting private property would forfeit a month's pay and have to work 30 days on fortifications. Jeff stood beneath a big elm tree on the town square, fanning himself with his cap. He enjoyed being in a big town again. The horses around the shady Capitol Square fought off swarms of dog gnats with their tails and pawed the plank fence to which they were tethered. People milled about, talking and visiting in musical, low-pitched Cherokee voices. There was the clank of boots on the board sidewalks, the creak and jingle of harness, the measured ringing of a blacksmith's anvil, the snarling of strange dogs meeting in the street, the mingled odor of fresh horse droppings and baking bread, and the whoop and laughter of children playing. Jeff was assigned to a small escort that accompanied Captain Clardy and some of the Union officers. They wanted to find a house where meals might be procured. As they walked along the street, frightened faces watched them from around the edges of window curtains. Dogs walked up, stiff-legged, to accost Dixie, but she stayed close to Jeff's heels and paid no attention to any of them. In the middle of town, they approached a handsome log house, shaded by several majestic sycamores. Obviously, its owner was a man of considerable wealth. They turned into its ornate front gate with wrought-iron hinges and walked up a path of gray chat bordered by bushes of yellow roses. Jeff saw that the rafters of the house were of peeled pine poles, held together with wooden pegs. Behind the property were slave houses and a barn. Ignoring the property's magnificence, Clardy clumped boldly onto the wide front porch and, flanked by Jeff's patrol, rapped sharply with his knuckles on the heavy oaken door. The door opened from the inside and revealed a girl. A very pretty girl. Her black sun-streaked hair was caught in a dark green bow. She was carrying a big white Persian cat, which at the sight of Dixie began to swell up angrily like a peacock. Jeff's mouth flopped open, and he got a weak feeling in the pit of his stomach as though thousands of butterflies were beating their wings madly inside him. Although the girl's skin had a brownish cast, her complexion was lovelier than wild strawberries. Breathless, he wondered what any girl that pretty was doing in this far-off Indian town. When she saw the blue-clad Union soldiers, the girl shrank back quickly. Her small round mouth parted with surprise and displeasure.
"My officers and I are hungry," Clardy growled. His sly, nervous eyes darted past her into the house. "Order your servants to fix us some supper." As usual, his tone was surly and domineering. The girl raised her oval chin a trifle and looked fearlessly back at him.
"Since you freed all the Negroes, we're not even cooking dinner for ourselves," she said. "We're all rebels to the backbone."
Proudly, she gestured behind her.
"My mother and two sisters live here. They all have husbands in the rebel army."
Her voice was melodious and low-pitched. Jeff saw that despite her hostility, she was a girl who went well with July. Even a hot, drought-stricken July. She was wearing a long cotton dress of light green and looked as fresh and clean as a green shrub after a rain. Clardy's face purpled.
"I'll brook none of your rebel impertinence," he roared in bullying tones. "Which will it be, supper for us, or must I burn your house down and set an example to the rest of this yappy Indian town?"
The girl didn't back up an inch.
"I've no doubt, sir, that if any white man would stoop to that sort of barbarism, you'd be completely capable of it," she said.
Clardy stood on the porch, sputtering helplessly. A Union officer who wore the gold shoulder bars of a major on his blue dress coat stepped forward, smiling courteously.
"Firing the house won't be necessary, Captain, I'm sure."
He faced the girl, sweeping off his black hat and bowing gracefully from the waist.
"May I speak to your mother, please?"
He was Major Thompson of the 9th Wisconsin. The girl's stormy brown eyes settled on the major. She said coolly,
"Wait here, please."
But as she started to withdraw, the big white cat in her arms flattened his ears and began to moan threateningly way back in his throat. Jeff's dog, Dixie, who had wandered up to the door, started calmly to follow the girl inside the rebel home, as though she had lived there all her life. With an angry yowl, the cat jumped out of the girl's arms and landed on Dixie's back. Quickly, he discovered he had overmatched himself. In an instant, dog and cat swept past the girl and, vanishing into the dark interior, began a running battle through the house. With a little gasp of dismay, the girl ran after them. Appalled, Jeff could hear the crash of china, the soprano screams and protestations of the women, the incessant barking and growling of Dixie, and the wrathful snarling of the cat. The soldiers on the porch were laughing uproariously. Jeff stepped forward and looked imploringly at Major Thompson. He saluted.
"Sir, that's my dog. May I go get her before she tears the place up?"
The major nodded. Jeff darted inside and felt his dusty brogan sink into the deep pile of a rug. Looking quickly about, he discovered the room was elegantly furnished with armchairs and divans, upholstered in blue. The combatants weren't there, but Jeff could tell they had been. A small candle stand with slender, tapered legs had been overturned. A tall spinning wheel, wound with orange yarn, lay on its side on the floor, still whirling round and round. Jeff followed the uproar through a dining room and into the kitchen, where Dixie had cornered the cat atop a food cupboard. He snatched her up the quickest way he could, backward, her head behind him and her tail in front. Two other women, both young and well-dressed, were chattering hysterically as they cringed along the wall. The girl was with them. Jeff swept off his infantry cap.
"Ma'am, I'm awfully sorry," he apologized, backing out of the room, with Dixie under one arm.
As the dog squirmed to free herself so she could renew the battle, her tail kept swinging round and swabbing Jeff in the mouth. Like a statue of cold fury, the girl stood. Her eyes were blazing.
You Yankee," she began, unable to find the words she wanted. "Get out." "Yes, ma'am," said Jeff.
As he bore Dixie back through the elegant parlor, he saw lying on a table a large Bible bound in blue leather, with the name Levi Washburn engraved on it in silver. He blinked. He had never seen anything like this in Kansas. It seemed strange that he had to come clear to the Indian country to see a home as plush as this one. As he carried Dixie out the front door, her excited barking rang noisily through the halls. Finally, a young woman came to the door. She had the same proud lift of chin as the girl, but looked older and seemed to have better control of her emotions. She told them that she was Mrs. Adair, an older sister. She looked pale and frightened. Major Thompson swept off his hat and bowed.
"I'm sorry to discommode you, ma'am, but my officers and I haven't dined today. Is there anybody here who could fix us some dinner?"
"There isn't any firewood," she answered. "We have plenty of food, but no fuel."
The major told her that he would see that she got plenty of firewood.
"And I'll post a guard around your premises to see that you aren't harmed," he promised,
noting the uneasy look she gave the soldiers.
He turned to Clardy. "Captain, may I borrow your escort as wood procurers and also for temporary guard duty?" Clardy had no reason for refusal. He nodded and turned toward Jeff. Jeff knew Clardy was going to order him to cut the wood. He hoped he would. He wasn't afraid of Clardy. He wasn't afraid of work, either. Besides, the work might give him a chance to see that pretty rebel girl again. "Bussy, here, will cut your wood," Clardy said to the woman at the door. "And if you've any other odd jobs to do, like peeling potatoes, or emptying swill, or digging stumps, or digging graves, Bussy will be glad to do them, too. He's had lots of experience, haven't you, Bussy?" Jeff straightened, popped his heels together, and saluted briskly. "Yes, sir." He didn't mind Clardy's abuse anymore. While he was cutting the wood outside the town limits, he learned from a Negro passing by that Levi Washburn was a captain in Stand Waite's Confederate Cherokee Cavalry, and that the girl was his 16-year-old daughter, Lucy. Just before supper, Jeff drove a wagon, heavily loaded with the chopped wood, up to the house. He knocked on the back door. The young woman who had identified herself as Mrs. Adair opened it a few inches. She carried a saucepan in one hand. Jeff swept off his cap. "Ma'am, I've fetched the stove wood. Where would you like me to stack it?" The woman seemed surprised at Jeff's kindness. She showed him where to put the wood in the yard. "Ma'am," offered Jeff, "do you have a wood box in the kitchen? If you want me to, I'll be glad to fill it for you." She hesitated, then nodded. When Jeff returned with his first armful, she showed him where to stack it. Two women, with aprons tied about their waists, were busily cooking supper for the officers. In an adjoining room, he saw a big, heavy-legged dining table of oak spread with plates and silver. His jaw dropped. They ate in a different room than they cooked in. Jeff could hear ham frying. He smelled what he thought were hot, mealy Irish potatoes roasting in a pan set in the fireplace ashes. He hadn't tasted a roasted Irish potato in months. "Thank you, ma'am," he said, trying to hide his hunger as he backed out of the house after filling the box. He hadn't seen the girl, although he knew she must be there. Major Thompson, Clardy, and three other Union officers knocked on the front door. They were admitted. Jeff, on duty outside, could hear them talking and laughing. He heard the rattle of the crockery and the jingle of the silver. Later, when his nose caught the whiff of cigar smoke, he knew they had finished eating. Glumly, Jeff sat on the rock fence that ran around the property. He wondered if Lucy had helped serve them. For the first time in his life, he envied the officers. They had the privilege of at least meeting her. Corn, but he was hungry. Dadgummed officers. It never occurred to them that their guard might be hungry, too. Just before dusk, the back door squeaked, and Lucy came out of the kitchen with a pail on her arm. Jeff's heart leaped happily. He guessed she had come to do the evening milking. The rest of the soldiers, who comprised the Union Guard, were lounging against the fence. When the girl walked by, they strained their necks and eyeballed her from head to toe. One of them whistled seductively and catcalled, "You know, I hain't hugged a gal for so long, I'm out of practice." The girl looked uneasy. At first Jeff thought it was because of the men. Then he found out that wasn't the only reason. With an assurance she apparently was far from feeling, she went to the barn, emerged with an armful of prairie hay, and dropped it awkwardly in a corner of the lot. Then she drove a brindle cow into the lot. Jeff watched her with foreboding. Even before she sat down on the stool, he doubted she had ever milked a cow in her life. And when she sat down on the wrong side of the cow, he was sure of it. A titter of amusement went up from the guard. The girl blushed scarlet. Jeff felt sorry for her, even if she was a rebel. He got down off the fence and walked up to her. She saw the dog and recognized him. As he drew near, Jeff felt dizzy. Again, he had the peculiar butterfly feeling in the pit of his stomach. Dadgum, she was pretty as a basket full of red monkeys. Twice as pretty as any girl he had ever seen before. He took off his cap. For a fleeting moment he looked into large brown eyes that were fringed with the longest, blackest eyelashes he had ever seen.
"Ma'am, you're supposed to milk from the cow's right side, not her left. I've lived on a farm all my life. Why don't you let me milk her for you?"
Angrily she arose, grasping the bail of the empty bucket in her hand and drawing it back threateningly as though she were going to belt Jeff over the head.
"Get out, or I'll call the major," she breathed furiously. "Take your old Yankee dog and get out."
Jeff stopped, dead in his tracks.
"All right, ma'am. Only she's not a Yankee dog. She's a Confederate dog."
Back on the fence, his chin in his hands, he watched her gloomily.
Corn. She was the sauciest girl he had ever seen. Why couldn't she forget the war long enough to let him help her milk the cow?
The rebel girl was dead game, even before an enemy audience. This time she began to milk from the correct side. The blue-clad guard applauded with hand claps and more catcalls. No matter how hard she worked, very little milk came from the cow's udder. Finally, after she had labored 20 minutes and had drawn about 20 teaspoons of milk, she went into the house, pursued by the jibes of the soldiers. Vaulting the fence, Jeff walked into the stone smokehouse and found a small wooden pail with an upright stave as a handle. Although it looked clean, he drew fresh water from the well and washed it. Then he milked the cow and, carrying the milk to the back door of the house, he knocked. The door was opened by a third Washburn daughter.
"Ma'am, here's the rest of your milk," Jeff said.
The young woman was taken aback. She stared at the piggin and the fresh, warm, bubbly milk in it.
"It's clean, ma'am," Jeff assured her. "I scrubbed the bucket carefully in your smokehouse." "We're very beholden to you," she told him, and accepted it. "We've always had slaves to do our milking, and now that they're gone, my mother has been doing it. But she didn't feel up to it tonight, so Lucy said she'd try."
She smiled a little and looked back over her shoulder at Lucy, who was washing the dishes in a large gray porcelain pan on the cupboard. Lucy blushed but didn't say anything.
"You look most too young to be in a war," the young woman continued more kindly. "You ought to be home with your mother."
Now it was Jeff's turn to blush. His face flamed crimson. His hands tightened on his blue cap. If all the women in the country, both Union and Rebel, kept telling him he looked like a schoolboy, it must be true.
"How old are you?"
17, ma'am," Jeff replied. What would Lucy Washburn think of him now?
He smelled the odor of food in the big candle-lit kitchen. In spite of all he could do, his eyes kept wandering to the cooking fireplace of Native Rock, where he saw several large, fluffy, brown-topped biscuits languishing in an open Dutch oven. He could tell from their height that they were sourdoughs, his favorite back home. Lucy Washburn spoke from the cupboard.
"Liz, maybe he's hungry."
Astonished, Jeff could scarcely believe his ears. Lucy's voice, if he had heard it correctly, was gentle, sympathetic, kind. He shot a grateful look at her, but she bit her lip and kept her eyes glued on the dishpan.
"How long has it been since you've dined?"
Liz asked solicitously. Jeff felt his insides trembling. He kept big-eyeing the biscuits.
"Ma'am, do you mean how long since I've sat down at table to a square meal?"
She nodded.
"About a year, ma'am."
Liz gave a little gasp of surprise. Stepping back, she looked around uncertainly at the other Washburn women, as if hesitating to invite an enemy soldier into the kitchen where the family usually ate their meals. Jeff understood her reluctance. This was war. He was a Yankee soldier and might be shooting at a rebel husband tomorrow. She stood silent, her lips compressed. Jeff's heart almost stopped beating. He was so afraid she'd say no.
but her natural instinct for hospitality triumphed. She stepped back from the door.
"Won't you come in? We've all had dinner. We ate after we served your officers. We have plenty left."
"Yes, ma'am," said Jeff enthusiastically. "Thank you, ma'am."
He almost leaped inside, closing the door behind him. It was a nice kitchen. Besides the wide fireplace, there were tall cupboards with glass doors and a large oak table covered with a red linen cloth. The chairs were of oak and had leather backs. The long walls had been sheathed in oak paneling and painted brown. Overhead, the rafters were stained blue with yellow undersides. He wished his mother could see it. The food was good. As Jeff ate ravenously, the women busied themselves elsewhere, leaving him alone at the big table. But each time his glass of milk was empty, Lucy appeared quietly at his elbow to refill it. She also replenished the empty biscuit plate beside him and put two more roasted potatoes on his plate. Jeff wanted to talk to her, but he didn't know what to say. He was afraid he might say the wrong thing. He brushed the crumbs from his mouth and looked up at her.
"Ma'am, I'm sorry my dog disgraced herself this morning by fighting with your cat. Was there a lot of damage in the house?"
Lucy's chin lifted indignantly. She didn't speak. Carrying the pitcher back to the cupboard, she went on washing the dishes. Jeff felt his ears reddening. Miffed, he finished his meal and arose to leave. What was the matter with her? He thanked the woman named Liz.
"Ma'am, may I give some of those leftover scraps to my dog? She hasn't eaten all day."
She raked them into a paper sack.
"Thank you for doing the milking for Lucy," she said.
"I didn't do it for her, ma'am. I did it for the cow. It hurts a cow not to be milked."
Chin up, he walked proudly out the back door. He didn't want that rebel girl to think she could wipe her feet on him. Weir's Union Army didn't stay long in the Cherokee Nation. The weather continued hot, the grass burned to a crisp, and the supply train from Kansas was long overdue. Weir put the army on half rations, without vegetables. Alarmed, most of the officers wanted to return to Kansas. Weir not only opposed them, but became intoxicated and abusive. Finally, Colonel Salomon, the next-ranking officer, arrested Weir and took command. He marched most of the expedition, including Jeff's company, back to Fort Scott. Jeff had never seen such a sorry-looking array. The cavalry looked the shabbiest of all. Forage was so scarce that when the horses were picketed, they ate off each other's manes and tails. Most of the strong little ponies of the Indian Home Guard scouts were unshod and totally unfit for use after galloping over the rocky, flinty Cherokee land. With the coming of winter, Jeff hoped he would be allowed to go home on furlough. But the Department of Kansas had other plans. They decided upon a bold penetration of western Arkansas. Jeff's company was to be part of the invading Union Army. Jeff didn't know it, but he was destined to fight in a real shooting battle at last. Chapter 12. Battle of Prairie Grove. Rebels ahead. 12 miles south of Fayetteville in northwestern Arkansas, Jeff and the Kansas Volunteers overtook the main force of the enemy at the crossing of Illinois Creek. General T.C. Hindman, the rebel commander, had the stronger position. His 14,000 rebels, mostly Arkansasers, Texans, and Missourians, were defending a heavily timbered ridge known as Prairie Grove. The Union Army was stationed in open fields. Suddenly, they heard the booming of cannon. John Chadwick's china-blue eyes were popping with fear.
"Hark!" he called nervously. "What's that?"
Oscar Earnshaw snorted in fright and blew his nose.
"It ain't duck hunters."
"Wish to God it was," quavered somebody else.
It was 2 o'clock. Jeff didn't know it was Sunday until he dug the tiny calendar memorandum out of his shirt pocket. December 7, 1862, it read. Impatiently, he peered hard ahead into the timber held by the Confederates. All he could see was trees. Bill Earle changed his rifle to his left hand and, lifting one foot, looked at it wearily.
"Ow," he complained in his high, clear voice. "This blister's killing me."
A recruit from Leavenworth raised his canteen with both hands and drank deeply. Bright drops of water ran down his smooth cheek.
"Darn," he gulped, coming up for air. "Our new commander sure likes these forced marches."
Bill Earle scowled at his sore foot.
"He don't just like 'em, he loves 'em. 25 mile from Babcock to Cane Hill, then 12 mile chasing that rebel General Marmaduke all over the Boston Mountains, then 14 more today on top of that. That's better than 50 mile I've walked in the last 3 days. Back home, the farthest I ever walked was from the back door to the barn. Shucks, I'm too tired to fight."
He squinted disgustedly at his scuffed army brogans. Both soles were loose and flapping. They had marched all night to reach the battleground. It had been a dark, cloudy night, too. Several times the new commander had halted the column to scratch a match on his saber guard so he could see his compass and set their course anew. Although the calves of his legs felt heavy, Jeff hadn't minded the last 14-mile hitch in the warm, balmy weather. He liked the blue haze of the Arkansas mountain country. He had even liked the quiet mountain shower they had passed through yesterday. They had seen it coming across the valley, the falling, lifting clouds wrapping the mountain's piney shoulders in gray shawls of rain, while the thunder rolled and growled majestically. Unlike the rains in Kansas, there was no wind. Everything was so still that long before the rain struck the marching blue columns, Jeff could hear it, whispering softly on the fallen leaves a quarter of a mile away as it approached. Wearing overcoats and slickers or covering themselves with blankets and squares of oilcloth, the infantry had taken the drenching like stock in the field. Afterward, the smell of the wet pines was everywhere, and a small herd of cows, their clean-washed red and brindle sides gleaming in the bright sunshine, spread out over a roadside pasture. Today the sun was shining, and Jeff could hardly wait for the fighting to start. For the 20th time, he checked the priming on his rifle and the cap box in his belt.
"What's the new commander's name?" he asked curiously.
Earl snorted.
"I don't know his name. I sure hope he knows something about fighting."
A Towso-headed private from Shawnee Mission looked apprehensively to the southeast where the rumbling of the guns began to grow louder.
"We'll soon find out if he does."
Noah, who had set type on newspapers and seemed always to know everything, eased the pack off his broad back with his left hand while still holding the rifle in his right.
"His name's Blunt. He's a doctor from Maine. Used to be a sea captain before that. Moved out to Anderson County, Kansas in 1856. Been practicing medicine at Greeley ever since."
A grizzled private from Mineola spat a brown spray of tobacco juice onto the tan prairie grass.
"Gosh!" he swore disgustedly. "Commanded by a bloody sawbones. What'll the politicians think of next?"
"Wonder if he's a foot doctor?" Bill Earle asked hopefully.
The new sergeant glared belligerently at everybody.
"Stow the gab," he barked. "We're liable to be in action any minute now."
Pike waved one long arm in the direction of the Confederates.
"Those fellas over there mean business. They think they're fighting for their homes, their women, and their kids. If you don't think they're ready to take you apart, listen to this.
It's a circular Hindman issued 3 days ago to every man in his command. Our cavalry took 'em off of prisoners this morning."
He drew a sheet of yellow paper from his blouse and thrust it triumphantly into Noah's placid face.
"Here, Babbitt, you repeat it to 'em. I can't read."
Planting his size 12s wide apart in the prairie grass, Noah began slowly to read the rebel general's statement to his soldiers.
"Remember that the enemy you engage has no feeling of mercy or kindness toward you. His ranks are made up of Pin Indians, free Negroes, Southern Tories, Kansas Jayhawkers and hired Dutch cutthroats. These bloody ruffians have invaded your country, stolen and destroyed your property, murdered your neighbors, outraged your women, driven your children from their homes, and defiled the graves of your kindred. If each man of you will do what I have here urged upon you, we will entirely destroy them. We can do this. We must do it. Our country will be ruined if we fail. A just God will strengthen our arms and give us a glorious victory.
The men were stunned. Jeff was wonderstruck. It was his first contact with propaganda.
"Gosh, Noah," he blurted incredulously. "Is he talking about us?"
Noah nodded soberly. "He sure is."
Now the rumbling of the cannon came from all around them. Jeff was surprised that they were campaigning at all in winter. Usually both armies seemed to have an unwritten agreement that after the first frost each would go into winter quarters and not molest the other until spring. Apparently Blunt, their new commander, was an ignorant chap who had not been schooled in the accepted military customs. Jeff wiped an arm across his face. At that, he believed he preferred campaigning in winter, especially the clear, whiny winters of western Arkansas. Their last commander, a general named Schofield, didn't believe in winter fighting. Noah had found a St. Louis newspaper in a fence corner while they were chasing Marmaduke. In it was a dispatch from Schofield's army correspondent saying, "The Army of the Frontier has fulfilled its mission and has gone into winter quarters near Springfield, Missouri. General Schofield is about to leave for St. Louis to recruit his health, which has been shattered by long and arduous duties in the field."
"Huh," Noah grunted. "There's nothing wrong with Schofield's health. He probably went to St. Louis to try to get a promotion to Major General."
From the woods ahead, a drumming of hoofbeats. A squadron of Union cavalry, wearing long gauntlets, came riding helter-skelter out of the trees. It looked as if they had been used roughly. Some had lost their hats and carbines. Others had had their horses shot out from under them and were riding double. They had ridden into the timber, found the enemy, determined his position, drawn his fire. Now it was the infantry's job to go in and clean up, if it could. Noah spat on the ground in disgust. "Buttermilk Rangers," he said scornfully. Jeff didn't understand why Noah held the cavalry in such contempt. Mitchell jeered the cavalry openly.
"Better get on back to the rear, boys. You stirred up a fuss. We'll settle it for yous. Go on back to the rear and get you some more buttermilk."
Jeff saw a tiny circular puff of white smoke blossom above the trees. Then, suddenly on the prairie some 50 yards in front of their line, a dash of dust, and something whizzed noisily over their heads, buzzing like a monster bee. Blam! Jeff dove flat on his stomach. He felt a painful jar as several of his comrades jumped in on top of him to escape the glancing rebel cannonball.
"Boys, if I ain't flat enough, won't some of you please jump on me and mash me flatter?"
Bill Earle said weakly from the bottom of the pile.
"Get back into line!"
Clardy roared sternly.
"Eyes front! Stop your cowardly dodging! Any man leaving his station again will be shot!"
With the flat of his sword, Clardy spanked a timid recruit in the seat of his pants and pushed another roughly into position. Sheepishly, they reformed their line. Jeff felt his breathing quicken. He saw another tiny spiral of smoke appear above the tops of the trees. This time, a charge of grape came flying overhead, screeching like 40 locomotives. Again the men ducked instinctively, but this time only a few left the line.
"It's all right, boys," Jeff heard Bill giggle in his nervous tenor. "Just dodge the biggest of them."
Jeff felt a hysterical urge to laugh, but discovered that he couldn't. For some strange reason, his throat had gone dry as a bone. The insides of his palms itched, and he could hear his pulse pounding. Again, he checked the load in his rifle and was angry at himself. He knew there was nothing wrong with a rifle load. Furious because he couldn't control his odd behavior, he clenched his jaws and shook his head vigorously. He had looked forward so long to his first battle. And now that the long-awaited moment had finally come, he discovered that some queer species of paralysis had gripped his legs. His chest felt heavy, as if a blacksmith's anvil was weighing it down. It was hard for him to breathe. Noah looked at him anxiously. "What's the matter, youngster?" Jeff licked his lips and swallowed once. Perplexed, he shook his brown head.
"I don't know. My stomach feels bashful."
Embarrassed, he looked around, hoping nobody would get the wrong idea and impute this accursed nervousness to cowardice. He was fiercely determined not to disgrace his family or his county. Suddenly, the Union drums began to roll, loudly and ominously. The noise was startling. Jeff's lips flattened on his teeth. He squinted down the line of infantry at the nearest drummer boy. To his surprise, he saw Jimmy Lear. Then Jeff remembered that there were Missouri troops in action. General Herron's two divisions had marched gallantly more than 100 miles from Wilson's Creek, Missouri, to support them. Varnished drumsticks whirring in his hands, Jimmy was staring sternly straight ahead and stepping lightly up and down as his feet marked the time, a look of concentrated duty on his boyish face. "Flemadee-dee-dee, flemadee-dee-dee," rang the drums weirdly and vibrantly. Jeff stretched his neck, trying to catch Jimmy's eye so he could wave at him. But Jimmy was keeping his mind on his business.
"Fall in!"
Obediently, Jeff backed into line, dressing up on Noah's tall form next to him. A spiteful crackle of rifle fire, punctuated by the deeper roar of cannon, broke suddenly from the woods. Now the stinking, acrid odor of gunpowder was on the air. A rebel bombshell screeched over their heads, hunting for them. Jeff imagined he could hear it say, "Where is ya? Where is ya? Where is ya?" Boom! He began to hear tiny thuds here and there in the ground. They reminded him of the first isolated dropping of hailstones during a spring storm on the Kansas prairies. Tardily, he realized they were rebel rifle bullets.
"Fix bayonets!"
Mechanically, Jeff groped for the scabbard at his belt. Fingers shaking, he managed to clamp the long knife over the muzzle of his rifle. He shot a quick look at Noah. It was good to have Noah next to him.
"Be ready, youngster. We're going in after 'em," Noah yelled.
Jeff pulled a couple of long breaths and felt the goosebumps rising on his arms. He heard Clardy cursing. Big Jake Lonigan had thrown down his musket and run in terror to the rear. Jeff felt a powerful urge to follow him. He could hear the officers shouting threats, too, but they failed to stop the big sergeant or even to slow him down.
"Eyes front!" bellowed Clardy. "Any man leaving his position will be shot!"
Swallowing nervously, Jeff found he couldn't keep his thoughts on the coming battle. Oddly, they kept wandering back to Linn County. It was a Sunday afternoon, and his family had probably just returned from church in the Rock Mission at Sugar Mound. He could see his mother, busy over her fireplace ovens, cooking the Sunday dinner, with Bess and Mary both helping, each careful not to soil the Sunday dresses they hadn't yet taken off. He could see his father unhitching Jack and Beck from the buckboard, and Ring, crouching mischievously by the gooseberry bushes, waiting to give the mules a run when they were liberated through the corral gate. Tears stung Jeff's eyes. Angry at himself for showing emotion, he winked them off. What in the world was the matter with him? The rebel fire grew hotter. What funny music the rebel mini-balls made. Some of them mewed like kittens, others hummed like angry hornets, or whined like ricocheting nails. A soldier on Jeff's right went down with a strangled moan, clutching and raking at his stomach. Jeff began to pray hard, straight from the heart. He hadn't dreamed that war was anything like this.
He vowed that if by some miracle he came out alive, he would always go to church thereafter.
"Forward! March!"
Jeff barely heard the command above the battle's din, but every man obeyed. Bayoneted muskets carried at the ready, they strode blindly forward to whatever fate awaited them. Angrily, Jeff thought of how little control a soldier in the ranks had over his own destiny. It was a soldier's business to starve to death, take the guff from the officers, march all night, and be shot to pieces in the daytime without even opening his mouth in protest. Suddenly he felt a violent anger. The officers had him, coming or going. He was like the farmer's dog trotting to town beneath his master's wagon. If he stood and fought, the town dogs all ganged him and whipped the way out of him. If he turned and ran for home, they chewed his tail from behind. Either way, they had him. Bullets zipped all about them. Jeff wondered how it felt to be hit by a musket ball, whether it stung or whether it burned. He wondered why their own artillery hadn't begun shooting. Looking to both right and left, he found himself part of a long, blue line of soldiers moving at a quick walk toward the woods ahead. Men all around him were taking off their coats and dropping them on the prairie. Jeff peeled off his, flung it to the ground, and felt a little better. He wouldn't need it anyhow because he expected to be killed. "Flemadee, flemadee, flemaditee," rattled the drums, sounding their doleful call to death. They entered the woods. A wounded horse screamed in agony. Stifling an impulse to turn and run, he clenched his teeth and kept advancing, dreading what lay ahead, because he couldn't see it, nor imagine what it was like. Although it was December, sweat ran down the tip of his nose, the winter sun gleamed brightly off his steel bayonet. Noah, tall, gaunt, looking grim as death, was walking in a low crouch, his bayonet-tipped musket held in front of him. Jeff felt a little better. Just being close to Noah helped. The presence of the other men helped, too. He stumbled over a fallen log, but kept going. His mind was sharp now. He began to recall all the mean things he had ever done and how he might never have time to atone for them. Life was running out on him. He wasn't ready to die. He didn't want to be rushed into it. He needed more time to think about it. After all, a person died just once. Anybody who let himself get killed was just plain stupid. The world was a wonderful place to live. No matter how revered he was in life, a dead person was so completely out of things. Even his own relatives soon forgot him, and quickly reshaped their lives without him. Bloom! Bloom! A sudden rush of air passed overhead, and Jeff's heart leaped thankfully. Casting a startled look back over his shoulder, he saw streaks of orange-gold flame burst from Blunt's forward guns as the Union batteries, elevating their cannon, fired over the heads of their infantry, using two-second fuses. For the first time, he appreciated how dependent the infantry and artillery were upon each other.
"Charge, bayonets!"
With a wild yell, the long blue line leaped forward. Sprinting at breakneck speed, Jeff yelled at the top of his lungs, too. Their little red and white striped flag with a blue patch in the corner was going along with him at a jerky motion. There was a steady rattle of musket fire ahead. Gaps were torn in the line by the rebel volleys. They began to run through clouds of sulfurous smoke. It stank and made his eyes smart. Thud. Down went a man at Jeff's elbow. Thud. Thud. Men were dropping all around him. Now they had reached the fringe of the timber and were stumbling through the brush. Thud, thud, thud. Jeff saw comrade after comrade pitch to the ground. But Noah was still at his right elbow, panting and grunting as he plowed laboriously through the greenbrier and the shinery. With mounting rage, Jeff wondered when they would be allowed to fire, retaliating to the volleys that were mowing them down like oak stalks before the sickle. He felt a wild impulse to fire anyhow. Still running, he looked ahead through the trees, and there the rebels were. A long line of men clad in mingled brown and gray, partly obscured by powder smoke.
Wearing tan campaign hats, they were standing shoulder to shoulder, shooting muskets held at face level. When the advancing Union line saw them, they pulled up and raised their guns for a volley.
Fire!
From one end of the long blue line to the other, red spouts of flame leaped from the bayonet-tipped muskets of the Kansas Volunteers. As his finger tightened on the trigger and the gun recoiled against his shoulder with the first shot, Jeff felt a vast relief. With both armies now at full firepower, he was conscious only of the awful thunderclap of battle. There were no clear thoughts in his head. Breathless, he thought neither of victory nor defeat, but rather that the end of the world was coming and he was only a small, unimportant part of this tremendous spectacle that was a swift prelude to it. A rebel bullet sheared off a branch a yard away. Jeff dove to his knees, furious at the stupidity of both armies standing in line and shooting at one another like duelists at 10 paces. On his right, he saw Noah firing carefully off one knee. That still wasn't low enough for Jeff. Flat on his belly, he began firing as fast as he could. Loading a single-shot musket was an intricate operation. Rolling over on his back, he bit off the end of the paper cartridge, thrust it in the gun, poured powder into the muzzle, withdrew his iron ramrod from the groove beneath the barrel, and rammed the charge and the bullet down the barrel. Then he pulled the hammer back with his thumb and stuck a percussion cap on the nipple. After that, all he had to do was draw a bead on the enemy and press the trigger. With the firing of the shot, smoke and fire from the black gunpowder belched into his face, and then he had the whole thing to do over. Each time he fired, Jeff scrambled to his feet, ran forward a few steps, then dropped again to reload. He bit the cartridges off so fast that he swallowed some of the spilled powder. It tasted bitter. He wanted to rinse his mouth, but he couldn't. His canteen had been full of good, cold Arkansas spring water, but he had foolishly thrown it away with his coat. Hot with battle now, he felt only that he wanted to encounter the worst and get it over as quickly as possible. Then, with shrill yells and screams and do-or-die expressions, they met the rebels hand-to-hand in the dark gloom of the trees. Using clubbed muskets, fists, knives, stones, anything they could get hold of, Jeff hurled himself upon a big fellow in brown, shrieking at the top of his lungs and thrusting upward with his bayonet. He felt a sharp stab of pain across the knuckles of his left hand as his opponent parried the thrust with such force that both muskets were knocked to the ground. Scowling, the rebel crouched to recover his musket. Jeff rushed him fiercely, tackling him by the legs. As the man fell, he snatched a long, wicked hunting knife from his belt and tried to slash his way free. He began kicking violently. Jeff dodged the knife and tried with all his might to hang on to the rebel's legs. Suddenly, his view was blocked by a blue pant leg as somebody stepped close to his face. He looked up in time to see his benefactor swing his rifle downward like an axe. Clonk! The sound reminded him of the squashing noise a melon makes when it's dropped onto a stone walk. The thrashing legs in his grasp trembled violently and grew still.
On your feet, youngster.
Noah, his brown face looking unnaturally ferocious in the gray gloom, reached down and, with one mighty jerk, lifted Jeff to a standing position. His mouth was smeared with black powder as though he'd been eating it. As Jeff bent over to pick up his musket, he saw the brown line of rebels retreating through the woods, loading as they backed away.
Wait!
Noah yelled hoarsely, glancing through the smoke at his right. A slow panic blossomed in his powder-begrimed countenance.
Looky there. Millions of 'em.
Jeff looked, and his jaw fell open with alarm. An entire rebel regiment, the men swarming like ants, had completely turned the right anchor of the Union line and, boiling out upon the prairie, was threatening to outflank them. They were after a federal artillery unit that had just arrived and was running up its long black guns. The rebels were tearing the top logs off a rail fence so they could clamber over, charge the Union guns, and capture them.
"Let's go help 'em," Noah proposed.
Jeff didn't think much of the idea, but he didn't hesitate. By that time, he would have followed Noah anywhere. Noah ran with long, awkward strides, Jeff at his heels. A tall battery lieutenant with red stripes on his tattered blue pants and tiny crossed cannons on his cap lumbered awkwardly to meet them. He cast frantic looks over his shoulder at the rebels forming behind the rail fence only 300 yards away.
"Will you fellas help us?" he pleaded. "My cannoneer deserted. One of our crews is short-handed."
Quickly, he showed Jeff how to carry the heavy tin cans of canister, each charged with 85 round lead balls weighing an ounce, from the ammunition wagon to the guns, which were muzzle-loading Parrots on two wheels. It never occurred to Jeff that if a rebel shell made a direct hit upon the ammo wagon, they would all be blown to kingdom come. A long ram with a sheepskin swab on the end was thrust hurriedly into Noah's hands. Hoofbeats thudded behind them. A stubby, scowling, thick-set man with a heavy black mustache and small beardlet rode up on a bay horse accompanied by several federal cavalrymen. He took one look at the menacing rebel movements, then began barking orders in a raspy growl. Noah stole one sharp glance at him.
"That's Blunt," he told Jeff. "That must be his personal staff and bodyguard with him."
The Greeley doctor seemed to know his business. Quickly he moved the battery by right flank, reforming it until it faced the oncoming Confederates. Then he dismounted his bodyguard and staff, forming them in protective support to the battery.
"In battery action left! Load with canister! Fire at will!" roared Blunt.
The lieutenant set off the brass gun by dealing the pin in the touch hole a clout with the butt of his pistol. It seemed to jump 2 feet into the air.
"Bluey!"
thundered the gun.
"Bluey! Bluey! Bluey!"
thundered companion pieces nearby. Jeff felt a painful pressure on his eardrums and was nearly knocked off his feet by the concussion. Doggedly, he tried to ignore the awful noise and concentrate on his new job.
"Rammer!"
the tall lieutenant shouted, frowning fiercely. Noah leaped forward, thrust his ram in the gun's muzzle, and with one scythe-like sweep of his long arm quickly completed the operation.
"Swabber!"
the lieutenant roared. Noah stuck the sheepskin end of his ram into a box of water and again thrust it down the gun's maw, cooling it. Now the lieutenant fixed his compelling eyes upon Jeff.
"Loader!"
he yelled. Jeff ran to the gun, pushed home his cartridge can, and jumped back. Again the tall lieutenant stepped forward and swung his pistol butt.
"Bluey!"
Now the guns were firing so rapidly and the ground was shaking so badly that Jeff had to stand on tiptoe. He couldn't take the terrible concussion flat-footed. His ears were throbbing from the continual roar. The black smoke from the cannon drifted everywhere, exuding a sour stench. Jeff heard a shriek of horror and saw that one Southern shell had wiped out a complete federal battery unit. One man had both legs sheared off below the knee. He was yelling at the top of his lungs with agony. Jeff knew the rebel sharpshooters had moved up. Deadly marksmen, they were picking off the Union gunners one by one. Rebel mini-balls began to pepper around them, but Jeff kept feeding canister into the big gun. He saw an enemy ball brush off the lieutenant's cap. Other balls skipped noisily off the barrels and wheels of the cannon. The battery horses whinnied in terror. General Blunt and the staff officers moved in closer, firing at the rebel sharpshooters. The noise of the cannonading was so great that each time Noah completed his swabbing duty, he would scamper away several yards and crouch in the brush, a finger stuck into each ear. But he always returned to the gun. Jeff shot a worried look at the advancing rebels and saw that they were wavering. Shoulder to shoulder, 6 and 7 men deep, they were a target the Union battery couldn't miss. The rebel dead and wounded were lying in long, still swaths. The woods behind them were ablaze with fire.
"Elf!"
somebody shouted to the tall lieutenant. Something was wrong with the offside wheel driver of the near-side gun, an Indian with a smooth face and long black hair sticking out from under his campaign hat. There was a puzzled, vacant stare in his black eyes. Without saying a word, he sat down weakly. Reaching behind him, he placed his hand on the ground and lay down as quietly as though he were going to sleep. The swing driver next to him went coolly to his side and examined him. Straightening up, he turned both thumbs down expressively. Jeff knew the man was dead. Suddenly, the southern fire slackened. Jeff was relieved to see the rebels falling back into the woods. The tall lieutenant, his brown hair bared to the breeze, swung his guns around on the Confederate artillery and quickly got the range. After ordering half a dozen more rounds fired, he waved both long arms, a jubilant smile on his face.
"Cease firing!"
he shouted, and cocked his head, listening. The rebel batteries didn't answer. All he heard was the rattle of the Confederate gun carriages retreating over the rocky ridges. Everywhere, the fighting had stopped. Jeff was surprised to see the sun sinking in a welter of purple clouds. It was dusk. What had seemed to him like an hour and a half had in reality been the whole of the afternoon. His dirty face beaming, the lieutenant asked for Jeff's and Noah's names, scribbled them on a dirty piece of cartridge paper, and thanked them profusely. He said proudly,
"We fought 'em flank and rear and licked 'em ever clatter."
Dazed, Jeff sank down onto the grass. Miraculously, he was still alive. His ears still rang from the battle din. His eyes were red and smarting from the dust and the cannon smoke. His knuckles ached from his bout with the big rebel infantrymen in the woods. He felt indescribably tired and dirty. From all around he could hear the pleading moans and cries of the wounded as the ambulances of both armies gathered up the worst hurt. Already burial details, hoisting little white flags on sticks, were digging long trenches in the flinty clay soil. Jeff was shocked at the rough, indifferent manner in which the dead were rolled into the trenches and the clay and gravel shoveled on top of them. Noah towered over him like a tall wraith, his brown eyes grave.
"Well, youngster, you joined up to fight in battle. Now that you've been in one, how'd you like it?"
Jeff raised an ashen face and shook his head positively.
"Noah, anybody that ever joins anything is crazy. I'll lay in the woods until the moss grows on my back a foot long before I'll ever join anything again."
He felt that being alive was the biggest miracle in the world. Thirsty, they began walking, looking for water. It seemed that everybody else was thirsty, too. Soon they came to a little creek thronged on both sides by ragged, exhausted men in blue. Men and horses were drinking thirstily, side by side. There were so many men that soon they stopped the creek from running as they tried to scoop the muddy water into their mouths. Jeff and Noah decided to wait until morning. Dark was falling. It was growing colder, too. Now they were sorry they had thrown away their coats. Union soldiers were breaking up fence rails to feed their fires. The firelight flared brightly in the soft Arkansas dusk. At the rate the rails were disappearing, Jeff knew the entire fence would be gone before midnight.
"I'm hungry," Noah said. "But the commissary wagons probably won't be here until morning. Guess we better forget about food and find us a place to sleep."
Jeff nodded dully. He was dead tired all over. He was hungry and thirsty, too. But his fatigue overbalanced everything else. He looked up. There were still a few streaks of lilac in the western sky. Finally, they found a straw stack. Burrowing into it, they went quickly to sleep, lying close together, spoon fashion, for warmth. Chapter 13. Expedition to Van Buren. Jeff lay on his back in the long grass, one army blanket under him and another over him. It was pleasant basking in the Arkansas sunshine. Bone tired, he felt as if he never wanted to get up. The ridge broke the breeze, and he could feel the sun's rays warming him through the blanket. It felt as though somebody were stroking the outside of the blanket with a hot iron. After sleeping all night in the haystack, Jeff and Noah had walked 14 miles without any breakfast before they reached Ray's Mills. There they found Blunt's baggage trains and mess wagons awaiting them.
Gratefully, they devoured the hot coffee, fried salt horse, and cold hardtack, and had their lost equipment resupplied by the quartermaster. Then they flopped down in the warm December sun. Jeff would have liked a bath, but he was too tired to strip off his sour clothing. He lay in a comfortable stupor, reviewing with awe the battle he had survived.